Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Dr. Arnold Schmidt, Associate Professor of Business and Society and Head of Social Impact at Stellenbosch Business School in South Africa. Arnold has a varied career in church ministry, business consulting, and now academia. He's an international authority on business ethics and a leading commentator and coach on vocational living and whole person learning. I spoke to Arnold online from his office in Cape Town. Welcome to Change Hackers, Arnold.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be in conversation with you.
Arnold, you've got a, like many people, what you might call quite an eclectic career. You know, we don't all have the benefit of hindsight when we start out, but sometimes when you look back on your career, you see logical stepping stones of how you got from one thing to another. And in your case, you've spent time serving in the church, you've started out training in psychology and philosophy, and then went into theology, and then went from the church into business, and then on from that into management and leadership education. What's your sense looking back on your career so far in terms of where the logical stepping stones, and you know, how would you characterize how it's led from one thing to another?
Yeah, it is quite interesting if you pick that up. In my house, for instance, my wife is a medical doctor. In other words, she's a career person since she studied and completed her studies, and she's ever been for many years. I have started out also with the ideal to become a medical doctor. I started medicine in the beginning. And then from there, going to theology, going to consultation, going to business, and eventually arriving at the business school. And I think over time, I've discovered that I am not necessarily comfortable within the confines of a career life, but that I rather am more comfortable with a portfolio of a variety of things that I am busy with at the same time. And what I think stuck with me over all these years, and with which I can still say that that is the backbone, irrespective of where I've worked and what I've done, is that I came to understand my life calling as one that is deeply embedded in a life calling that's got to do with change and transformation. And specifically understanding my life's work in the sense of that it's always been caught up between deconstruction and reconstruction. Always been caught up in what does it mean to let go of the old and venture into the new. And thereby also at the same time, what does it mean to live and work at the interface of things? With which I mean, yes, on the interface between theology and business, theology and society, business and society, interface of different disciplines, and at the interface of different sectors. Much of my work has been done lately from this kind of portfolio existence in business, in civil society, and in academia. So there is a constant, even if it might look like a bit confusing, I think, from the outside.
But and you sense make as you go, don't you? I mean, this is the thing. You know, you sometimes a step to the next stepping stone is a leap of faith, yes. And it's not until you look with hindsight you realize why, as you make sense of it.
Yeah, well, if I look back in terms of how the different moments I think that carried me from the one to the other was. For instance, intuitively knowing that medicine was not the way to go, but at the same time also realizing, and maybe from where I've grown up, the values that shaped me, the kind of conditions growing up in rural South Africa with a love for the land and a love for the country's people and so forth, intuitively knowing that theology and ministry was the alternative. And then arriving in a parish and to experience over a period of about 4 or 5 years, but this is a very narrow environment, and that I would rather have to to live in a context and work in a context with a broader scope, with broader boundaries and kind of broader horizons. And then the question was what? And I started out with what I love to do most, and that is to journey with people through change. maybe because of the fact that it is happening or was happening at that stage and still is so in my own life, but also as a result of living in a country that was caught up in chains at the time. I mean, this was during the 80s and the 90s that I ventured into this, which was exciting, but also anxious times in our country. Later on realizing that in a life of consulting and facilitation, I still need to have a different skill set, which then moved me towards going with the same frame of mind, working with people caught up in chains and being confronted with transformation and transition, and working in business for 3 years, which was more in a kind of an HR field. And then from there, got the invitation to the business school. When I look back, I've never applied for anything, really. It was a matter of moving, I think, in the context of the feedback of my surroundings and the inner reflection and intuition of what needs to happen next, that the choices came and that the connections came.
So would you describe yourself as an opportunist?
I've never thought about it like that. I don't think it's about opportunism. Not really. I think it is more about trying to live in a way that is connected, that is reflective, that's trying to interpret where am I, what's kind of my deeper inner longings, where can I be of service, where is kind of the next phase, the next step to do something that is meaningful, where I can link up with people with certain needs and things that what I have to offer that I can connect to. And in that sense, moving along. So I guess from the outside, it might look like opportunism, but I've never thought about it like that, you know.
Well, it sounds to me, to some extent it is, but it's informed by the inner voice. It's what seems like a very strong sense of values, of mission, of where you're trying to go with your life and what your purpose is. And you know, it sounds like you rely very heavily upon that conversation with yourself around, you know, does this opportunity align to where I'm trying to head? And if it does, then it's something you push yourself into, even if it's a leap of faith in terms of, you know, into a different arena that you've not worked in before.
There's something I think insightful and important in terms of what you said. For me, it really is embedded in what I would call vocational living. And taking it from where I'm coming from, where people have mostly in the past associated the idea of vocation with a life in ministry, I don't think about it like that. I don't think about vocation as something that is reserved for people in clerical roles. I think about vocation as something that is deeply human, as something that has got to do with what we believe, what we value, with what our sense of purpose is. And vocational living can be exercised in any career, also in a formal career. And vocational living can be exercised in a portfolio existence. In the one case, it might be about the enduring long-term application of knowledge and skill in a specific discipline. And in another sense, it can be a skill set that you offer over a broader variety of context and in different areas of life. But it's that skill set then that connects with where the needs of society in general might lead you towards. And for me, it has worked out in terms of the latter. I've started with the one and realized that it is difficult for me to live in those kind of narrow confines of a career-based existence, mm-hmm. and finding a lot of joy in the portfolio existence, but strongly inspired by what I hope to say is a form of vocational living.
I mean, coming back to what you're saying about a life calling, which you described about being immersed in change and transformation. I mean, going back to what's your earliest memories and influences that you can recall that has led you down that path?
There are a few things that I could think about. The one, for instance, in terms of a very early kind of awareness, having grown up in apartheid South Africa in a rural town where agriculture is the main industry of, I remember in the mid-70s at a time when things were really very confusing and messy in South Africa, that we had a school debate, where in a typical fashion in a school debate, I had to take the position that integrated sport, now you will remember where South Africa was coming from, that integrated sport is right. And my side won the debate, and my history teacher came to me afterwards and said, it was a very good speech. Luckily, you do not have to believe in what you've said. And I then said, sir, you will be surprised. So from there on, it was the realization that things can't stay the same in our country. It has to go somewhere else. There's a different reality that we need to create. Having led on to in a university, when I was on the Student Representative Council and responsible for leadership development in the student community on the campus, where we were in a weekend meeting with people from the other side of the racial divide and even on the other side of the political spectrum. And we spoke for a weekend with fellow students from a nearby university about what patriotism means. And I discovered that we share the same land, we share the same history, but we look at patriotism from different vantage points. And that experience remained with me until this day. How is that possible? And what needs to happen? What kind of conversations do we need to have in order to bring these different vantage points to the same conversation, and that we see how we can grow and become more on the other side of that, more also in our togetherness? And simply from there on, I have discovered within myself a deep interest in change and transformation, how it works, how communities go through it, what the dynamics around these kind of conversations are. And I've simply just ventured out and said, let me try this. Let me try this on my own. And this is also what inspired me after a few years in ministry to start doing this as a vocation and make myself available to have these kind of conversations with people. So on the one hand, there is the more open conversation, the open debate, the being confronted with a problem that we do not know the solution to, but we need to venture into the unknown of my work. And on the other side, there might be the more structured, the more strategically orientated kind of consulting work that came out of that. And by the way, I don't really like calling myself a consultant, but because I think there's also connotations to that concept. But be as it may, I'd rather like to call myself a facilitator of dialogue and problem solving.
So looking back, to what extent do you think that the context you were in, you know, in a South Africa going through a massive shift, you know, coming out of apartheid, you know, the realization that one person can make a huge difference on their own, but also there's something empowering about that for others that actually will, you know, the situation we're in is not hopeless. You can, you know, individually and collectively drive change and transformation. You know, did that feed into, you know, your take on change and transformation at the time in terms of, well, you know, this isn't for others, this is something that I can do as well?
I would like to say that I haven't done it alone, and I've done it with others, which we can talk about later. But the point that I would like to make in this regard is that the marvel of the new South Africa around 1994 and the years leading up to that was really that we could find a solution through listening and conversation. That was the big marvel, that the dialogue could take us on the other side of the precipice.
And I guess empathy and forgiveness were a massively important factor as well.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we see until this day how difficult that might be for people, because 20 years on, we still are being faced with great difficulties, and we have lost some of what we have gained around that period. But the one side of that was that dialogue can take us on the other side of what seemed to be insurmountable problems and challenges. The other side of that was also the realization that there is a challenge to leadership, leading in a different way, leading in a way that what I and a few friends who have ventured into this together at the time what we have called facilitative leadership. It's the kind of leadership that are not prescriptive of how people should go through change, but create and helps to create the conditions for having the conversations, for creating the understanding in which it becomes possible to go to the other side and journey forward together. Also deeply embedded at the time in storytelling, understanding simply just the story from the other side, out of which then you can build an agenda around which you can do some collective work the challenges that need to be dealt with. So the two things then, dialogue and facilitative leadership, I think were the two things that we held on to and that I specifically held on to since then in terms of the kind of work that I'm doing. And I'm always surprised that it's not just changing potentially others, but it's more than anything else, it's changing me. Every time that I'm in it, it's changing me.
Can you give me an example?
In the years past, I've had many storytelling sessions with large groups of people. And often when we do these storytelling sessions and follow it up with sessions around change, around conflict management, around building communities and teams and organizations who are relationally resilient and more healthy, less toxic than what it was before, and what it means also at the same time to come to terms with who we are as individuals within that space, I was always astonished by what can happen when people really listen. And listen without fighting, listen with respect to the other side. And I remember so clearly one day when we were in a meeting of a team of facilitators, having done this together for quite some time, that we've asked the question, so why do we keep on doing this? And there was a spontaneous answer, myself and the others included, that we just said, you know what, you become addicted to this because it keeps on changing you. It keeps on changing us. You can't be untouched when people go through these breakthroughs.
So something of your own growth mindset is fundamental to getting personal value out of the work as well as being effective for others, I guess, as well. Because it requires a certain humility and an appetite for learning from everyone around you.
And you can't stand on the outside of that as if you are the one who knows. You are together with the others in the midst of that stream where you try to find the way forward. There's no way of just looking in. There is a sense of embeddedness, solidarity when we move with people into those spaces.
So this massively informs your approach then to leadership development with students you have coming through Stellenbosch. I mean, it strikes me that it's perhaps somewhat at odds with students' perceptions of what they think leadership development is going to be about. You know, the traditional concepts of leadership for a fresh-faced student coming, you know, embarking on an MBA program with very limited management and leadership experience of their own might be somewhat different from the kind of approach you're espousing. So what kind of reaction do you get when they first get exposed to this kind of an approach?
I think sometimes surprise, because when students expect to be lectured to be put in a position where dialogue is welcome, where everyone's story is respected and sacred, where the classroom becomes a listening environment, where we are not there to win debates, but to understand the other one's point of view and create room for that. And it's also being fed with what I would like to refer to, which is not a new term, but whole person learning. We cannot just learn intellectually. We also need to learn emotionally. We also need to learn in terms of our bodily experience. What is it to carry within us the anxieties about the unknown in the story of the other one? And then at the same time, once you have listened to the story on the other side, with respect and the perspective of the other one on a particular issue, realizing that you do not hold the truth on your own. I think that the real breakthroughs in terms of learning start to happen. So from a classroom perspective, yes, from an executive education perspective, which I also do quite some work in at the moment, specifically in one of the programs that's really my joy and my delight, is that I'm the director of the director development program of the business school, the Africa Directors Program, where we take the same approach with directors. We take them serious as people and follow a whole person learning approach in a very self-confrontational way, because we deal with them as leaders and as ethical persons and leaders, working through the gray zones of decision-making, finding their own inner strength and their own sense of purpose and values. Once people have reconnected with that, you know, when they get back into a conversation that is a tricky one, they're not confronted with the issue on the table.
Right.
They're confronted with who they are. And that makes the difference. And that's then their calling and their turn to connect and to stand up and to say, this is not just about what I think. This is really about who I am in the face of what needs to be decided upon. And I think that's the marvel of the journey, when you see that kind of transformation happen in people.
And this seems to me it's at the heart of how we respond to the challenge of leadership for the future, the kind of world we're facing, the complexity of challenges, the systemic issues, and so on. But if people were more receptive to employing the kind of approach that you're espousing around you know, a much greater emphasis on listening skills and empathy and deep connection with people, and a readiness to ask better questions rather than feel like you have to have all the answers, it points away towards a less stressful, less pressured way of leading through change. Would you recognize that?
I certainly recognize that. I have a very good Kenyan friend who taught me and who always reminds me, Arnold, let the question be our teacher, not the answer. Because the dilemma with answers are really that answers shortcut the learning. Answers might either be coming from a position of authority or from a position of not listening well, not taking the other one seriously. And I really believe that we learn much more through the questions that we are able to ask, because questions invite people into a conversation. Answers and some types of answers, I think, shortcut conversations, shortcut the breakthroughs that we are looking for. So I certainly recognize what you are saying. The other side of that is, I think conversations, I mean, one should not be premised in all your conversations on asking questions and questions and questions. That's the point I'm trying to make. But I think questions are also speaking about the willingness to be vulnerable and showing that that you also are willing to be in the space of not knowing. And I think that is important.
But does that come so easy to alpha males and females?
You ask whether that comes equally easy for males and females.
Well, I'm recognizing, first of all, that there are both alpha males and females. it's not just the old stereotype of alpha males. You know, there are plenty of very...
Alpha, you know, males. Sorry, that's what you said.
Ambitious men and women. Who are climbing the greasy pole, believe that they have to show strength and, you know, lack of vulnerability. You know, how do they respond to this invitation to be vulnerable?
I think people respond well to that. What I see is when people are realizing, and specifically in one of the subjects that that I do not teach it necessarily as a subject, but I mean, it's part of the academic work that I do, and my core interest, specifically from a business school perspective, is how do we integrate ethics, responsibility, and sustainability in business decision making and strategy. And when I help people to understand that ethics is never about human perfection, but it is about sincerity and integrity and the willingness to own up, even if you need to recognize that you've been wrong, that we can get further along the down the road in terms of changing things and creating a healthy
situation. In fact, it takes strength to do that. to admit you're wrong.
Yeah, and I'm reminded about two South Africans that I think stand really out in that regard. Nelson Mandela, having been in prison for so long and then coming out with a strong position around reconciling with my enemies. That's not an easy thing to do. But that was the marvel that it was not just for South Africa, but for the world. This enigma of a person who have been who has been in prison for so long and stepping out and say, but reconciliation, meeting my enemy in a different place, in a different way, that's the way forward and that's good leadership. Another person, for instance, who has also been recognized as a South African to flip to the female side of what you're asking, is advocate, nowadays Professor Thuli Madonsela, who was recognized by Time as one of the 100 most influential people in the world last year, the public protector of South Africa. And what stands out for me from her is how can you stand firm on principles and values but never lose your sense of compassion? She was able to live on the high end of the pressure of her office, and on the other end, to still stay connected to the small people and the vulnerable in society. And that, I think, is making her the kind of leader that we have come to know her to be. It is in that humility and vulnerability and willingness to also recognize where I've been wrong that a real strength set. And that, I think, is something that we as a society should not lose. It might be that we are advancing, technologically speaking, and that we are advancing in terms of how we organize in great ways. But this is what makes us human. And this is what makes us true to who we really are and can be, and how we can venture into the future.
And to what extent do you think that the capacity to do that, because it's not universal, we don't see it in everyone. Some are much better at it than others. To what extent is it nature versus nurture? I mean, is it something you could teach everyone to be able to do? Or is some of it about environmental conditioning, you know, early formative experiences in childhood or early adulthood that are heavily informing someone's approach and sort of humanity?
I don't have a scientific answer for you to your question. But what I do realize is that in terms of my own story, this is the kind of home in which I grew up in. I grew up with parents who were willing to be vulnerable, with parents who were really serious about living life as a calling, growing up with parents who respected the dignity of all people and showing empathy with those around them, and specifically those in need. So whether it is nature, in my case, I don't know. Whether it was nurture, I certainly had great examples that I could take from. Maybe it's both. Maybe it's both, and it's a mysterious combination for many people in terms of some might start in one end and end in another place. Some might start at the soft end, at the end of empathy and compassion, and might, for certain reasons, be hardened by the experiences of life. I can just say that when I look back, I was fortunate to have had the examples of people who respected Indeed. The dignity and the humanity of others. Yeah.
Unfortunately, not everybody is as fortunate as that to have those kind of positive influences in their early lives. But clearly, the more people who think and act that way, the world would be a better place for it. So I can't help wondering, as an educator, you know, what's your take on how we could be more intentional as a society? In terms of developing people with the right kind of qualities and values and attributes that you've spoken about, so we don't have to, you know, so that they're growing up as you know, becoming adults in a more intentional way like that. You know, it's perhaps a question of better parenting, sending everyone back to class to learn how to be a better parent, but. You know, notwithstanding that, you know, how at a society level, how do we deal with this issue? You know, on the basis that, you know, on the hypothesis that having more people rather than less that showed this level of compassion and love for others and so on would be a great thing.
I think educationally speaking, we need to find the balance between learning, experience, and reflection. The intellectual learning needs to be there. Therefore, a university is what it is. But there's also the one thing that I think universities owe their students, and that is to expose them to experiential learning and service to society, helping them to understand what it means to be stewards of society in the full sense of the word. But I think there is also a new appreciation nowadays for reflection, for mindfulness, for spirituality, if you wish, where people are also being helped to get in touch with themselves. Developing the full person in an academic setting, I think this is what we owe our students in terms of what we offer them. Broadly speaking, in society, I think it might become a bit more complex. How do you cultivate this in a business? And in that particular sense, I think it's a leadership thing. For leaders to be known for their integrity, on the one hand, integrity and fairness, yes, but also empathy and compassion on the other. For understanding that a business is not just only about profit. It is also about long-term sustainability and endurance. It is about a society that must flourish. Otherwise, business will not live. I'm more concerned in terms of what's happening in the political space. Because in the political space, it seems to be inevitably about power. And the power of words, the power of policies, and the pressure to have one solution that needs to fit everything. And we seem to be living in a world where vulnerability in politics is kind of scarce. And vulnerability doesn't mean meekness. Vulnerability doesn't mean that you can be swayed in any particular direction according to how the wind blows. Vulnerability doesn't mean that you step away from your values. And that's my concern about what I sometimes think about politics. It's opportunistic, power-driven, and not very helpful in terms of creating societies in which this kind of processes of healing can happen. But I do think that in academia, in our academic institutions, we can do this. And we can produce, I think, a different and a new generation of responsible leaders and stewards of society, which hopefully will change politics one day as well, in as much as we hope them to change businesses.
Yeah. What do you think is going to make the biggest difference to progress in this area of change and transformation that you clearly care so deeply about? Mm.
I think what frustrates me is the slow pace of change, and that people seem not to see the urgency of where we find ourselves as a human community living on a finite planet with declining resources. There is a lack of urgency and sometimes a huge amount of stupidity, and sometimes also an unwillingness to find the real integration between what we so often refer to as economy, society, and environment, or the real integration between facts and values. Yielding those kind of modernistic dualisms of the past and finding more realistic and systemically interdependent ways to go forward. And it's difficult. It's difficult for me as well. I mean, I'm not just finger pointing. But I do think that we can speed up the urgency. That's the one thing. I think the other thing and it might be more contextual, it might be more having to do with the country in which I live and the things that I see around me, but I don't think it's just limited to South Africa, is people who keep stereotypes alive instead of being open to learn from difference and diversity. People who keep gender stereotypes alive. People who keep stereotypes alive around sexual preference, who keep stereotypes alive around color and race. And language. This is not helpful. And we need to get beyond the stereotyping of the other. Otherwise, we are not going to accept the sincerity, the humanity, and the dignity of the other so that we can go forward together. So that would probably be the two things that I would say, you know, frustrate me most. In terms of where help would come from. Of course, part of that is that which I owe myself, and that is that I should maintain the mental and the physical strength to maintain the sense of calling on the one hand, and to maintain the commitment for collective learning together with others. And that, I think, is a part of the self and inner discipline that one needs to maintain in your own life. But then help from others, to link into that part of your question, I might perhaps help others to help me to maintain a realistic workload, because we might try, and I might try, to do too much at once. Also, in terms of getting honest feedback, honest and transparent feedback, in terms of where, even in the sense in which I would seem to be purposeful and passionate in terms of how to approach the challenges that I see around me, I might run the risk of doing it in a way that might do harm and actually do not bring healing. And therefore, we need other people to do this together with us and to give us the feedback.
Right. Well, we can all have blind spots, can't we, or unintentional consequences of our own actions. Wonderful. Arnold, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And thank you for joining me today on Change Hackers. Really much appreciated.
And thank you for the opportunity and confronting me with those questions.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.